I'm Tracy from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Are you a small business owner or even someone who dreams of entrepreneurship? Then check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from iHeart Podcasts and Intuit QuickBooks. Join hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres as they interview entrepreneurs sharing insights around starting and nurturing a small business. You won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too.
The Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie? I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Tracy V. Wilson.
And I'm Holly Fry.
In our most recent installments of Unearthed, we talked about a hand prosthesis that had been discovered in Bavaria that dated back to sometime between the 15th and 17th centuries. And in reading about this, articles mentioned various other prostheses that had been found in archaeological sites and a mention of Gottfried von Berlichingen, also known as Guts of the Iron Hand. What really caught my attention in that this mention was that his prosthesis sounded a lot more complex than I really would have imagined for the time that he was living in. I want to stress up front that more complex prostheses are not inherently better than less complex ones. So much depends on what the person actually using the prosthesis needs and wants and can find most comfortable and can access and afford, and some people don't want to use one at all. We also live in an age in which there are a lot of very well-meaning engineers designing very complex prosthetic limbs without the involvement of the people who would actually be using them. That has started to shift a little bit, but the prosthetics industry is still really not being led by prosthetics users, which is something that applies to adaptive technology more broadly also. So I don't want to give the impression that the prosthesis, there's two of them, that the prostheses we're going to be talking about today were like automatically better than ones that were a little simpler, like what we talked about on Unearthed. Also, some aspects of this research were complicated because a lot of what is out there about him is in German. Some of the more recent English language work has been written or published by white nationalists. Aside from his own story, which is a story about, you know, a historic German figure, there was an SS Panzergrenadier Division named after him during World War II. So he's somebody that white nationalists have kind of appropriated in some ways. We'll talk about this more in the Friday behind the scenes, but it did mean that there was some stuff that was off the table as research material because I'm not buying a book from a white nationalist publisher for the podcast.
What? All right, so Gottfried von Berlichingen lived during the transition from what we think of as the medieval period to the Renaissance. Most historians frame the medieval period in Europe as starting with the end of the Roman Empire in the 5th century, although there are various arguments for earlier and later events and dates. In terms of the start of the Renaissance, different scholars cite different years, stretching all the way from the 1300s to the 1500s.
So we've talked about on the show before, these historical periods are a framework that scholars have created to help us understand and conceptualize the past. And one reason that the end of the medieval period and that transition to the Renaissance can seem a little fuzzy maybe more so than the beginning of the medieval period, is that a lot of the changes involved were really gradual. It was not like somebody flipped a switch and Europe was suddenly in the Renaissance. There were changes in political, religious, and economic structures that took decades to really develop a lot of the time. You can point to various pretty clear-cut historical moments, like the Black Death from 1347 to 1351, or Martin Luther writing his 95 Theses in 1517, but these more discrete moments were part of these ongoing overlapping changes. And some of these gradual changes from the medieval period to the Renaissance were happening over the course of Gottfried's lifetime. They affected him directly, and this included the Protestant Reformation and a military shift from knights to professional military forces.
Gottfried von Berlichingen was born in 1480 or 1481 in the Duchy of Württemberg, presumably at Jagdhausen Castle, also called Gutzenberg, which was the Berlichingen family home. Today, this is in the German state of Baden-Württemberg, and at the time, it was part of the Holy Roman Empire. Gottfried's father, Kilian von Berlichingen, was a Reichsritter, or an imperial knight of the Holy Roman Empire, meaning his fealty was to the Holy Roman Emperor, not to the Duke of Württemberg. This was both a military and administrative role. Reichsritter were typically both warriors and landlords.
Kilian had been married twice before marrying Gottfried's mother, and Gottfried was the youngest of all of his children. So, Gottfried had a lot more wealth and influence than, say, people in the peasant class and even some of the members of the more provincial nobility. But being the youngest son of a minor noble put him at a disadvantage compared to people like his older brothers and a lot of other men in the same class. Much later in his life, his autobiography would frame this as having pulled himself out of just total poverty through his valorous service as a knight.
When he was young, Gottfried went to school for about a year, but he was far more interested in horsemanship than in studying. When he was 14, he became a page to a knight named Conrad von Berlichingen, who was one of his father's cousins. Conrad died in 1497, at which point Gottfried was sent to serve in the court of the Margrave of Ansbach, which was another principality of the Holy Roman Empire. This apparently did not go well. Gottfried was described in terms like willful, hot-headed, and headstrong, and he also doesn't seem to have been at all interested in what was going on at court. So he was squired to another knight, Veit von Lettersheim, who was in the service of the Holy Roman Emperor Maximilian I.
In 1499, at the age of about 19, Gottfried was considered to have completed his training as a knight. And at first, it seems like he wanted to follow in his father's footsteps as a Reichsritter. But it also seems like he decided he wanted a life that had more excitement and less responsibility instead. So within a year, he had left the service of the empire and joined up with a robber knight known as Hans Taliker von Messenbach.
Earlier, we mentioned a shift in the way that militaries worked, with knights being replaced by soldiers. Knights typically went through a lengthy training period with other knights, like Gottfried's time as a page and a squire. But soldiers were being recruited from outside the nobility, and they were trained more quickly by professional military instructors. Knights had been sworn to serve members of the nobility, and they were typically of noble birth themselves. So this shift meant that knights and nobles had progressively less power and influence. Some of them then turned to other means to try to gain power and wealth. The term robber knight could encompass anything from a landlord who was treating his tenants unethically to try to bring in more money, to knights who literally robbed people or kidnapped them and held them for ransom.
Hans Taliker von Messenbach was apparently more of the latter. One of the sources that was used in this episode described him as notorious. He and his men attacked trading caravans, and they ransacked villages, and they did so much of this that the Swabian League took up arms against them. The Swabian League was an alliance of cities, states, and individual nobles who mutually agreed to defend one another from this kind of raiding and to band together against things like imperial tax increases and land seizures. Gottfried von Berlichingen and the Swabian League had a lot of encounters over the course of his life.
One of Gottfried's cousins decided that he was going to get himself killed if he didn't find something else to do with his life, and he convinced Gottfried to leave Hans Tallaker. After this, Gottfried became a mercenary during the Landshut War of Succession, which we will get into after we pause for a sponsor break.
I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
My name is Johnny B. Good, and I'm the host of the new podcast, Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. Over this 9-part series, I'll explore the life and crimes of my best friend, Ray Trapani.
I always wanted to be a criminal.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
You see, Ray has this unique ability to find loopholes and exploit them.
They collected $30 million. There were headlines about it.
His company, CentraTech, was one of the hottest crypto startups in 2017. It was going to change the world, until it didn't.
I came into my office, opened my email, and the subject heading was FBI request.
It was only a matter of time before the truth came out.
You can only fake it till you make it for so long before they find out that your Harvard degree is not so crimson.
How could you sit there and do something that you know will objectively cause more harm in the world?
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Briefly, the Landshut War of Succession was a dispute within the House of Wittelsbach, which ruled Bavaria. In 1329, Holy Roman Emperor Louis IV, who was a Wittelsbach, had signed the Treaty of Pavia, which divided Bavaria into two portions, with each of those portions ruled by one of his brother's sons. Under the terms of this treaty, if the family line that was ruling either one of these regions came to an end, meaning if somebody died without a male heir, the other one would take possession of it. More than 150 years later, George, Duke of Bavaria-Landshut, had no son and tried to name his daughter Elizabeth as his heir instead. Duke Albert IV of Bavaria Munich, who was supposed to inherit Bavaria Landshut if George died without an heir, went to war over this.
Gottfried von Berlichingen fought on Albert IV's side, working as a mercenary. In this case, Gottfried and the Swabian League were on the same side, but he was fighting against two of his brothers who had sided with Bavaria Landshut. Another of Albert's allies was the imperial city of Nuremberg. And on July 14, 1504, Gottfried was injured when a cannon fire from Nuremberg's forces hit their allies' lines and a cannonball struck his right hand.
Gottfried was fully armored, but the impact of this cannonball forced the pommel of his sword in between his gauntlet and his arm piece, and it crushed and nearly severed his hand. His injured hand had to be amputated at the wrist.
He was lucky to survive this injury. We've talked on the show before about the work of surgeon Ambroise Paré, who made huge advances in European methods for performing amputations. We're going to have that as an upcoming Saturday classic. And some of the techniques typically involved in amputation before Paré did his work actually damaged the tissue and made it harder for people to recover. Paré's work included things like the reintroduction of ligatures to control bleeding, and this work was still about 40 years away when Gottfried was injured. Joseph Lister's antiseptic surgical techniques and even developments like the tourniquet to slow severe bleeding, those were all still centuries away. Gottfried spent more than 6 months recuperating, barely leaving his bed until February of 1505.
Even given the state of medicine and surgery at this time, there were, of course, other people who had also survived these kinds of injuries and amputations. And while Gottfried was recovering, he remembered another knight who had used a prosthetic hand. He decided that he would have one made for himself, so once he was well enough, he went to a blacksmith to commission one.
This prosthesis was made of sheet iron, about a millimeter thick, and painted to resemble his skin color. It was attached to a cuff to fit it to the wrist. The fingers moved in pairs, so the index and middle finger moved together, and the ring and pinky finger moved together, and the thumb could move as well. Using the other hand, Gottfried could move the fingers and thumb into different positions and lock them into place, and he could release those with a button.
For a long time, it was assumed that this prosthesis allowed Gottfried to wield a sword with his right hand. And he may have held a sword with this prosthesis, but he probably did not fight with it. It wouldn't really have been strong enough for that kind of movement and impact. So he learned to fight left-handed. But he could have used this prosthesis to hold, like, the reins of his horse or the strap of a shield or other similar objects. And this prosthesis also had a more cosmetic function. Wearing it meant that he still looked like people expected a knight to look. Soon, he was being known as Guts of the Iron Hand or the Knight of the Iron Hand.
Gottfried's return to combat involved a lot of feuding. Over the years, historians within and outside of Germany have offered different interpretations about the feuds that were such a big part of life among the nobility in the Holy Roman Empire. Some have framed feuds as a way for the nobility to preserve their rights, going into battle against other nobles or cities or states that threatened them in some way. Others have viewed feuding more as an almost ritualized way for nobles to try to preserve their honor or to seek retribution after being wronged. There were also some connections to the world of robber knights that we talked about earlier.
Aside from all these nuances, though, feuding overall was a way of using violence to resolve conflicts. Unsurprisingly, this caused problems, and it caused enough problems that in 1495, Holy Roman Emperor Maximilian I issued the Ewiger Landfriede, translated as the Perpetual Public Peace or Eternal Domestic Peace. This outlawed feuding. After this, disputing nobles were supposed to resolve their problems through legal channels, not through fighting. A lot of nobles, though, they just ignored it and kept feuding with one another anyway.
It's a way of life. In 1511, the electorate of Cologne demanded that Guts repay a debt. He refused, and he raised a mercenary company to fight a years-long feud about it. Then, in 1512, he and about 130 mounted mercenaries attacked a merchant caravan, leading to feuds with multiple cities, who either had merchants or travelers in that convoy, or sent forces to try to deal with the attack. After the caravan attack, Maximilian I placed Guts under an imperial ban and tried to seize all of his estates, but he managed to transfer them to family members before that could happen. The Swabian League demanded he pay reparations, and ultimately the imperial ban was lifted in May of 1514, after Guts paid 14,000 guilders.
Also in 1514, peasants in the Duchy of Württemberg rose up with members of the poorer urban classes, and they rebelled against the Duke. This was an uprising that came to be known as the Poor Conrad Movement. Guts was one of the people who was hired to suppress this uprising. And he also kept feuding and captured nobles to hold them for ransom. He made a lot of money through these various feuds and kidnappings and mercenary work. In 1517, he bought Hornburg Castle as his personal stronghold and residence.
In 1519, Götz was hired by Duke Ulrich von Württemberg to fight in a war against the Swabian League, during which he was captured. He was held at an inn for 3 years. In 1522, he finally negotiated a settlement for his release, including taking a vow not to participate in any more feuding.
Götz basically retired at this point, and it seems that he also converted to Protestantism. He doesn't spell that out in his autobiography, but reading between the lines, this seems to have been when this happened. He went back to Hornburg Castle. He spent some time with his family. But a few years later, he was drawn into another conflict that took him out of retirement. We will get to that after a sponsor break. I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs, and if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
My name is Johnny B. Goode, and I'm the host of the new podcast, Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. Over this 9-part series, I'll explore the life and crimes of my best friend, Ray Trapani.
I always wanted to be a criminal.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
You see, Ray has this unique ability to find loopholes and exploit them.
They collected $30 million. There were headlines about it.
His company, Centratech, was one of the hottest crypto startups in 2017. It was going to change the world, until it didn't.
I came into my office, opened my email, and the subject heading was FBI request.
It was only a matter of time before the truth came out.
You can only fake it till you make it for so long before they find out that your Harvard degree is not so crimson.
How could you sit there and do something that you know will objectively cause more harm in the world?
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
The Poor Conrad movement that we mentioned earlier was one of a series of peasant uprisings in the 16th century. Another is known as the German Peasants' War of 1525. Like the Poor Conrad movement, this was a response to taxes and duties that had been imposed upon the peasant class by the Swabian League. The Peasants' War was also connected to the Protestant Reformation and the idea of a person's individual faith and relationship with God rather than the supremacy of the Catholic Church.
The peasants involved in this uprising drafted a set of demands to present to the Swabian League, known as the 12 Articles. These included the right for each community to choose its own pastor and provisions for how tithes given to the church should be used. Some of the demands really highlight how few rights the peasant class had. They included things like the freedom to own property and the freedom to hunt, fish, and cut wood. These are things most peasants could not do, since nearly all the land was owned by the nobility, who did not allow anyone else to use it. There were also articles about fair rent and an end to oppression by the nobility.
Yeah, this is a pretty interesting human rights document. By late April of 1525, the Protestant fraternity of peasants had a fighting force numbering about 12,000, known as the Bright Shining Band, led by George Metzler and Wendell Hippler. Their numbers and the fact that about a quarter of them had firearms meant that they had successfully attacked some nobles' estates, but it was clear that they needed somebody more experienced to lead them. In some accounts, this was motivated by an incident in which the peasants had massacred the nobles in a city they had attacked. That had caused reformer Martin Luther to denounce them. So they decided they needed to find a leader who would not let something like that happen again. Regardless of the exact motivations, though, they went to Hornburg Castle and they lay siege to it, demanding that Gottfried von Berlichingen join them.
According to his later court testimony and his autobiography, he really did not have a choice in this, and he probably could not have withstood an ongoing siege at Hornburg Castle against a force that large. While he probably wasn't all that moved by the peasants' situation or their demands, aligning with them did pit him against the Swabian League and against a lot of nobles he'd previously had feuds or other disputes with. So while some of the more modern accounts kind of paint him as kind of an early Renaissance Robin Hood, rising up with the poor against the nobility, he really had his own reasons to participate, which seem pretty self-serving. He signed an agreement to take command on April 24th, 1525.
He and the Bright Shining Band then went around to other estates, recruiting, that is, forcing, other nobles to join them. This meant that there were progressively more and more people with the band who had experience in combat and tactics, and it also meant that Gutz had more people to back up his story that he had been forced into this as well.
On May 5th, Gutz and Wendell Hippler issued a declaration that significantly weakened the demands made in the 12 Articles. Gutz had already faced criticism from within the band, since there were people who knew about the role that he'd played in putting down the poor Conrad rebellion. But this weakening of their demands made people dislike him even more.
On May 8th, the Bright Shining Band lay siege to Würzburg, and eventually Marienburg Fortress was the only thing there they hadn't captured. The band tried to lay siege to it, but this was not nearly as effective as their earlier attacks on other towns and estates had been. This fortress was up on top of a hill, and it was very well fortified, and the land around it had been entirely cleared of trees and other cover as a precautionary measure, as word had spread about this advancing peasant army. So if they wanted to attack, it was up a hill. There's plenty of, like, line of sight from the people being besieged and, like, nowhere to hide on the way to get up there.
The peasants' army assaulted the walls of the fortress on May 15th, which was something else the force inside had already taken steps to get ready for. Although the nobles were vastly outnumbered, they had prepared things like boiling water and pitch to dump on the attackers. This whole thing sounds like it was a truly gruesome battle, and the peasants' army faced heavy losses. They didn't give up, though, and after this, they got some miners who had joined their cause to try to tunnel under the walls.
Eventually, though, reinforcements arrived from the Swabian League, and Gutz and the peasants withdrew. Morale started to fall in the Bright Shining Band after this, and people started deserting. On May 28th, Gutz said he was going out to do some recon, and he left, and he never came back. In some accounts, he then led a force that destroyed another branch of the peasants' army. Ultimately, whether he was involved or not, the peasant armies were defeated, and a lot of the people who had joined them were killed.
Gutz was subpoenaed to answer for his role in all of this in 1526. He argued that he had been forced into helping the peasants, and he said he'd strategically tried to minimize the damage that they were doing without them realizing it. He was exonerated by the imperial court that October.
But the Swabian League, who at this point had a very long and checkered history with Gutz von Berlichingen, they were not satisfied. They either lured him to a meeting by saying that they were going to clear him of some charges related to an earlier war, Or they just captured him while he was traveling. Either way, he was imprisoned for 2 more years and only released in 1350 after he paid reparations and swore an oath that he would not go far from home or even mount a horse.
His second prosthesis was probably made sometime after he was released. This one was more complex than the one that he'd had made in 1504. It went up to his elbow, and each of the fingers had 3 articulated joints, while his thumb had 2. Ratchet mechanisms inside the fingers and thumb meant they could individually be locked into position, and a button released them. The wrist could also be rotated 15 degrees in either direction, changing the angle of the hand. This allowed him to use the prosthesis to grip things that needed to be held at different angles, like the angle needed to hold a quill versus the angle needed to hold playing cards.
There were pros and cons with this prosthesis compared to the earlier one. The fingers could be moved individually, and the joints could be locked into more positions. In general, the second prosthesis could also be used to grip smaller, more delicate objects. But it wasn't as sturdy as the older prosthesis had been, and at the same time, it was a lot heavier. It weighed about 1,500 grams, while the older one was only about 600. That's about 52 ounces, or 3.3 pounds, as compared to the smaller prosthesis, which was only about 21 ounces, or 1.3 pounds. It's possible that he used both prostheses for the rest of his life for different purposes, like one for combat and the other one for leisure and Sundays.
I don't know why the idea that one is for leisure cracks me up, but it does. Especially because it's heavy. Like,
it's heavy, but you can hold your playing cards with it. Yeah. Maybe better than the other one.
Yeah. Presumably you're also supporting it with maybe a table, because if you carry around 3.3 pounds, that sounds like not much. But over the course of like a day or even a couple hours, it starts to feel really heavy.
Well, and this is one of the criticisms of like today's increasingly complex prosthesis, like made without input from prosthetics users, of this is so much heavier than the other one that I had before.
This does not help me. We mentioned that he might use one for combat, and that's because in spite of that oath he took, he did return to combat. In 1540, Charles V released him from his oath so that he could fight against the Ottoman Empire. In 1544, he was also part of Charles's campaigns against the French.
He did finally really retire sometime after the French campaign, and he really spent most of the rest of his life living at Hornburg Castle. He had been married twice, and over the course of his life, he had 10 children. He died in his sleep on July 23rd, 1562, at the age of 82, which I just find incredible, given that he spent so much of his life at combat. He spent a lot of his time in deadly situations and lived until the age of 82. His tomb is at Chantal Abbey in Baden-Württemberg.
In the last years of his life, Götz had become blind, and a year or so before his death, he narrated an autobiography to a scribe. Tracy has not read this since, as she said earlier, the only English language version that she could find was published by a white nationalist publisher, but based on critical commentary on older German language versions, it's a pretty self-aggrandizing work, which often does not match up with the historical record. Like we said, it makes it sound like he pulled himself up from poverty through knightly valor.
This autobiography stayed within the family in manuscript form until the 18th century. And then about 20 years after it was first published, Johann Wolfgang von Goethe used it as the basis for his first play that was called Götz von Berlichingen, which debuted in 1773. Götz had not really been a well-known figure in Germany before that, but Goethe's play framed him as a freedom fighter, and it turned him into something of a national hero. And then he became a character in multiple other German works, including operas, poems, and novels. And then Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart referenced him in at least 2 musical works, one of them being a canon called Leck mir am Arsch, or Lick My Arse.
This title is a reference to a quote attributed to Götz von Berlichingen, which was popularized in various fictional works about him. The story is that in one of his encounters with the Swabian League, he was besieged and ordered to surrender, and he refused, calling out the window, quote, "Tell your captain that for his imperial majesty I entertain as ever all due respect, but for himself he may kiss my arse." Sometimes that epithet is known as the Swabian salute.
Gutz von Berlichingen's two hand prostheses have gotten a lot of attention over the years. In 1815, engraver Christian von Meckel produced detailed diagrams of the second prosthesis and its inner workings. He had the actual prosthesis, or what we believe may have been the actual prosthesis, and he had permission from the family to take it apart for this purpose. Much more recently, in 1982, Günter Quasicrock worked with the same prosthesis, although without dismantling it, concluding that it had not been used for actual sword fighting. In more recent years, there have also been a number of projects to build 3D recreations of both prostheses and computer-aided design reconstructions. There are two prostheses in the collection of Jagsthausen Castle Museum today. They are generally described as the ones that actually belonged to Gutz of the Iron Hand, but it is not 100% certain that they actually were the ones used by him.
Oh, Gutz. Oh, good. That'd be a great name for a cat, by the way.
Yeah.
Except that it has now weird associations.
Yeah, a little bit. We'll talk about them more Friday.
Do you have unweird association email?
I do. This is from Kathy. And Kathy wrote, "Dear Holly and Tracy, I'm a longtime listener of Stuff You Missed in History Class and a proud Philadelphian. I was just listening to the behind the scenes on Rebecca Crumpler when you mentioned an archive collection at Drexel University about early Black doctors compiled by Margaret Gerardo. I thought to myself, that has to be the same collection. Let me explain. 2 years ago, I was privileged enough to take a special section of the course W.E.B. Du Bois and Philadelphia's Seventh Ward for Philadelphia Teachers with Dr. Amy Hiller at the University of Pennsylvania through the Teachers Institute of Philadelphia. The next year, Dr. Hiller taught this course again for Penn first-year students. She invited the teachers who had taken her class previously to watch her current students present their final projects." I'm going to pause from the letter to say that next, Kathy describes this project by these two first-year students at Penn. I listened to this podcast that they made. I thought it was very good. I don't want to, like, direct people to it. It makes me uncomfortable to, like, send a big podcast listenership toward first-year college student's school project. because I know what can happen when things escape the sphere you made them for on the internet, right?
Right.
it was a very good episode of the podcast, though. And, you know, if I were to hear from either of them that they were totally comfortable with me sharing it with the entire world, I would do that. But I don't want to do that without their permission. Back to the email. "You will hear in it that the collection was not easy to access, so don't feel bad that you did not go to it on your last trip, but maybe one day you'll have the time to return, search through it, and do a podcast on several on what you found out. I loved the podcast the two students made, but it left me wanting to learn more. Thank you for all that you do. As a history nerd and history teacher, I appreciate your podcast both professionally and personally. P.S. I am allergic to shedding animals, but as a pet tax, here is a picture of some of the beautiful snails in our fish tank. Sincerely, Kathy." These snails are beautiful in the fish tank. It looks like there are two of them. And the shell of one of them has this very lovely pink tone on it. And what I think is the snail's face is also pink. This is a very beautiful picture. So, yes, as I said, I listened to this this podcast episode that these students made. I really like it. What Kathy is referencing regarding the collection not being easy to access is they make a point that the library facility that it is in is open in sort of a Monday through Friday, 9 to 5 situation.
Right.
And it's also not at the main library branch. It's in a residential area. So, like, personally, had I been in Philadelphia with a day off during the week, that would have been something that I could have dealt with. But, like, having your collection only open from 9 to 5 Monday through Friday means that it's, like, out of bounds for a lot of researchers. Especially since another point that's made in the interview with Margaret Gerardo, there's just not a lot of funding, and there's especially not a lot of funding for Black historians trying to research Black history. And so a lot of people are doing this work in addition to other jobs. So having a collection that is only open during the week in, quote, business hours and is not, like, with the rest of the library facility just makes it harder for people to access that. So thank you so much, Kathy, for this email. Thank you so much for sending me the link to this podcast episode that the students did.
Thank you for snails.
And the snail pictures.
The snails are really, really pretty.
Yeah,
I will take a snail. I'm telling you, I can't think of an animal that's off limits, even if you have a pet roach.
Tarantula, scorpion.
I love tarantulas.
These are so great. My brother had a tarantula when we were kids. He sort of inherited the classroom tarantula.
Aww.
There was a whole story of like how this tarantula came to live in the classroom. Tarantulas can live for a very long time. We had to keep crickets in the basement to feed to the tarantula.
Yeah.
There are still crickets down there.
I had lots of tarantulas as a kid because we lived in Arizona and I would scoop them up off the street like a dummy.
Oh, fun. Okay, then. So if you'd like to write to us about this or any other podcast, we're at historypodcast@iheartradio.com, and we're on social media at Missed in History. It's where you'll find our Facebook and whatnot, mostly just where we put notifications. The new episodes are live. You can subscribe to our show on the iHeartRadio app and wherever else you want to get your podcasts. Stuff You Missed in History Class is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast host Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.